My lords, many people these days have both a short and a skewed historical memory. It's all too easy to go along with the assumption that Christianity is an import to the Middle East rather than an export from it. Because the truth is that for two millennia, the Christian presence in the Middle East has been an integral part of successive civilizations. A dominant presence in the Byzantine era, a culturally very active partner in the early Muslim centuries, a patient and long-suffering element, like the historic Jewish communities of the Maghreb and the Middle East, in that complex mosaic of ethnic jurisdictions that made up the Ottoman Empire, and more recently, a political catalyst and a nursery of radical thinking in the dawn of Arab nationalism. To be ignorant of this is to risk misunderstanding a whole world of political and religious interaction and interdependence, and to yield to the damaging myth that on the far side of the Mediterranean and the Bosphorus, there is a homogeneous Arab and Muslim world, a parallel universe. I don't need to elaborate for your lordships the dangers we invite in accepting any such assumption. The Middle East is not a homogeneous region, and the presence of Christians there is a deep-rooted reality. We are not talking about a foreign body, but about people who would see their history and their destiny alike bound up with the countries where they live, and bound up in local conversations with a dominant Muslim culture, which they are likely to see in terms very different from those that might be used by Western observers. Yet, at the present moment, the position of Christians in the region is more vulnerable than it has been for centuries. The flow of Christian refugees from Iraq, in the wake of constant threat and attack, has left a dramatically depleted Christian population there. And perhaps I can say in passing, how very glad and grateful I was to have stood alongside the Grand Mufti of the Al-Azhar Mosque in Cairo at a press conference here in London some 3 years ago, joining in condemnation of attacks on Christians in Iraq. Similar senior voices from Al-Azhar have, of course, been heard more recently in condemnation of anti-Christian outrages in Egypt itself. But to turn to Egypt, those issues are inevitably among the most immediate in the minds of many of us just now. Of late, the Coptic community has seen levels of emigration rise to unprecedented heights. And in a way that would have been unthinkable even a very few years ago, they are anxious about sharing the fate of other Christian communities that once seemed securely embedded in their setting. Perhaps the most troubling example, as your lordships will be well aware, is the case of the Palestinians, one of the most sophisticated and professional Christian populations in the region, and now a fast shrinking presence as a result of the tragic situation in the West Bank. But whether in Egypt, or in Israel and Palestine, or in Syria, what were once relatively secure communities are now increasingly seen as vulnerable. In Egypt, this involves a notably significant percentage of the whole population with a deeply distinguished history. And it's not surprising if the current situation is causing great apprehension, despite the many excellent examples of Christian-Muslim cooperation on the ground there. Now, the phenomenon of the Arab Spring has brought some new considerations into play. And that is why I'm particularly grateful that it has been possible to have this debate in your lordship's house today. Even as we speak, the future of the Arab Spring is still deeply unclear. It has not been, in any obvious sense, a religious movement. The energy for change has originated with those who want to see accountable government, participatory politics, a robust definition and defense of equal citizenship for all, an end to repression of opinion, an end to rule by security agencies who are free to bully and torture, an end to the culture of impunity. And perhaps it's worth noting, in the light of all that, that the 9th of December just happens to be International Anti-Corruption Day. But we need to remember, too, that so much of this is simply a demand that governments in the region act on the commitments to human rights and dignities to which they have already signed up in a variety of international agreements. The means by which this revolutionary energy has spread across the region have been the social networking media of our age, and the accessibility of good reporting from many sources, not least Al Jazeera. Yet the challenges to dictatorship have, just as in the Balkans, brought their own dangers and instabilities. What began as a distinctively non-sectarian set of movements has inevitably opened the door to some of those Islamic political activists who suffered repression under the old regimes. We wait to see exactly what agenda such groups will now want to advance as they win high levels of popular electoral support, whether this will mean new kinds of repression in which non-Muslim and, importantly, non-Orthodox Muslim communities will become targets for discrimination, or whether something more like the Turkish model will emerge. An openly and strongly Islamic government with equally a strong commitment to practical pluralism and political transparency. This seems to be the direction in which Tunisia is moving. We hope and pray that this may still be possible in Egypt. It's certainly not the case that we can assume that extremists are poised to take over the region tomorrow. But we still need to take with utmost seriousness the anxieties that are felt by communities already feeling exposed and uncertain. The Arab Spring has meant dramatically different things in different countries. And as these last remarks underline, there are a number of different political possibilities for governance grounded in Islamic principles. But against such a background, we may get a clearer sense of how and why the Christian presence matters, and why its future is surrounded by so many anxieties. No one is seeking a privileged position for Christians in the Middle East, nor should they be. But what we can say, and I firmly believe that most Muslims here and in many other places would agree entirely, is that the continued presence of Christians in the region is essential to the political and social health of the countries of the Middle East. Their presence challenges the assumption that the Arab world and the Muslim world are just one and the same thing, and that is arguably good for Arabs and Muslims alike. They demonstrate that a predominantly Muslim polity can accommodate, positively and gratefully, non-Muslims as fellow citizens, partners in an enterprise that's not exclusively determined by religious loyalties, even when rooted in specific religious principles. Now, Christians in the Middle East, my lords, are very sensitive to being described as minorities. For them, never mind the statistics, this can imply that they are somehow necessarily alien or marginal, rather than being both indigenous to their countries and historically bound up in the fabric of their societies. One of their real grievances is what they experience as the twofold undermining of their identity that comes from a new generation of Muslim enthusiasts treating them as pawns of the West, and on the other hand, from a Western political rhetoric that either ignores them totally or thoughtlessly puts them at risk by casting military conflict in religious terms. Talk of crusading comes to mind. They are looking at the prospect of centuries of coexistence being jeopardized in a new polarized global politics. Now, they have no illusions about the problems that have characterized their history, and the record of Arab and Turkish rule is not an entirely rosy picture. Memories are still vivid of segregation in various kinds under the Ottomans. And yet the Christians of the region will obstinately insist that this is a history in which they have been agents, not simply anonymous extras. Their absence from the region would entail a massive, damaging collective amnesia. Many of the Christian communities face a painful dilemma at the moment. Under some of the discredited regimes of recent years, they have enjoyed a certain degree of freedom from aggression or discrimination. The first tremors of political change were felt by some Christians as a bit of a threat to a status quo that, while anything but ideal, was a bit more bearable than some alternatives. And yet many of them felt equally that the popular pressure for accountable government and clear principles of civil liberty for all was a welcome development, indeed, a development of exactly the kind that so many Arab Christian intellectuals of the early and mid-20th century had eloquently argued for. The role of Arab Christian intellectuals in helping to galvanize several important movements across the region is still a story too little known in the West. At the moment, most of these communities urgently want to know whether the Arab Spring is going to be good or bad news for them, and for other non-Muslim or non-majority presences. And once again, it's worth insisting that concern for Christian communities in the region is inseparable from a concern for the overall good of the societies of which they are part. So, are there steps that can be taken, or at least priorities to be identified for us, in this very varied and complex situation? I trust that today's debate will bring to light some of the specifics on which people wish to concentrate. But one obvious overall point is that solutions can only come from within the societies of the region. And the task of those outside is not to impose their own agenda, and certainly not to do anything that adds colouring to the false and pernicious idea that indigenous Christians are somehow natural allies of a foreign government or an alien culture. But, that being said, it is important that we affirm as strongly as we can the importance of a political settlement in the region that will genuinely secure the good of all and be properly accountable to the peoples of the countries involved. Whether or not such a settlement involves a government conducted on Islamic principles matters less for these purposes than whether such a government is prepared to recognize an authentic status of citizenship for non-Muslims. And this is not about the creation, let me repeat it once again, of a special status for Christians or others, but about a general commitment to civic equality and the rule of law. This is why, incidentally, there is deep reluctance in Iraq to accept the idea of Christian enclaves as a solution to the situation there. Many recognize, with heavy hearts, that things may come to such a pass that there are few, if any, other options that will actually guarantee the safety of Christians there. But they still feel, surely rightly, that the creation of enclaves would be the yielding of a vitally important principle. It is possible to argue, on the basis of Christian and Islamic thought alike, in favour of transparent government and a proper notion of civic equality. This is not a matter of any narrowly Western idea of good governance. It's about basic political ethics. And that's the sort of argument about good governance as such that needs to be pursued if Christian communities are going to be secure in the future. Not any sort of case for special treatment, but a strong argument for justice, honesty, and respectful diversity in the societies of the region. But there is one other point worth making that brings the argument closer to home. Our long-term hope, as I have insisted in these remarks, must be that the communities of which I've spoken will have a guaranteed place in their historic homelands and in the political life and discourse of their societies. Meanwhile, though, many are still forced from their homes, and many end up on our own shores. One thing that often deeply intensifies the sense of being ignored and misunderstood is an attitude here towards Christian migrants or refugees from the region, which assumes that they must be Muslim because they are Arab. I'm sorry to say this, but I've heard such sentiments even from some in government in the past. It's an attitude that can sometimes also assume that they are converts whose faith depends on Western missions, and therefore in some way they are responsible by their own choice for their situation. A Palestinian Christian friend of mine was wont to say, when asked by Westerners, "When did your family become Christians?" "About 2,000 years ago." Now, we need some crystal clear guidance and education on these things if we are to avoid what is both a ludicrous and an insulting outcome. Syrian Orthodox children, for example, this is a real instance, told by teachers in a British school that they shouldn't attend a Christian assembly because they must be Muslims if they're Syrians. This is something we can do something about in short order, and I trust that government and public bodies will do it. In conclusion, let me say how very grateful I am for the opportunity to raise these issues today in your Lordship's House, at a time when they could hardly be more pressing. The potential for a radical political renewal throughout the Middle East and North Africa is immense, as are the risks. My contention has been that the security and well-being of the historic Christian communities in the region is something of a litmus test in relation to these wider issues of the political health of the region. And I hope that our discussion today will constantly keep those broad political and ethical hopes in focus. I expect some distinguished contributions to debate. And perhaps I may take this opportunity in particular of acknowledging with gratitude the presence of the noble Lord, Lord Sachs, in the chamber, and look forward to his contribution to our deliberations, because I am particularly aware that the observance of Shabbat will oblige him to leave the chamber early, and I am all the more appreciative of his support. My lords, I beg to move.